Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Lady Hubbard about her new novel, The Talented Ripkins. And we'll also hear from journalist Tom Sankton about his new book, The Betancourt Affair, The World's Richest Woman and the Scandal That Rocked Paris. I am so delighted to be talking with Lady Hubbard, whose wonderful first novel, The Talented Ripkins, is just about to arrive in the reading world. This smart, funny, tender, heartbreaking novel of an African-American family with extraordinary gifts will completely captivate you. Lady studied at Princeton, New York University, the University of Wisconsin, and UCLA, and now lives in New Orleans, where she teaches in the Africana Studies Department at Tulane University. She's the recipient of the 2016 Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and the William Faulkner William Wisdom Creative Writing Competition for the short story. Lady Hubbard, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, the title of this book, of course, is a riff on the W.E.B. Du Bois essay, The Talented Tenth. I wonder if you talk a little bit about what that essay has meant for you and for this novel.
Sure. It means a lot to the book. It's actually sort of the starting point. It's what I was thinking about when I began writing it. So it was written by W.E.B. Du Bois, and it was published in a very famous anthology of essays called The Souls of Black Folks in 1903. And what it says on the page, he's talking about a leadership class. He says there's a tenth of the African-American population that he says is sort of born with intellectual gifts and talent that will make them sort of prepared. They can become the leadership class for all African Americans. The essay actually means so much to me. It's kind of hard to figure out a way to condense an answer to that question because it's both what the essay actually says, and I also was really, I think, motivated by the way in which people talk about the term the talented tenth, because it's often associated with elitism. And like saying there's like 10% of the population is smarter and better than the rest of African Americans. And people tend to leave out when the essay is sort of abridged in that manner. He's really talking about responsibility to the less fortunate. And I feel like W.E.B. Du Bois's life is sort of a testament to his own faith and belief that what he was really talking about was that we all have a responsibility to the less fortunate among us. So I was very interested in how that essay was interpreted in popular culture when I wrote it as well. So I think that that is actually part of what is going on in the book, is the idea that there are certain people perhaps endowed with these talents, but what's really motivating Johnny in particular is this sense that he needs to do something with them, that he has this responsibility to use whatever talent, even if it makes no sense to other people, to use it and try to do something positive with it for others and the people around him.
Now, the Ripkins are such an amazing family, and this novel, among many other things, is a kind of road trip, which centers on Johnny Ripkins, who is 72, and he's taking this trip around Florida with his young niece, Eloise. And Florida is your childhood stomping ground, right?
Yes, I came to St. Petersburg, Florida every summer when I was growing up because my grandparents lived here. And I was very, very close with my grandmother and my grandfather. And that's where the road trip probably comes from, because I did take several road trips with my grandfather. And he certainly informs a lot of Johnny's personality and also his voice. Johnny talked quite a bit like my grandfather used to talk.
And then there's Eloise, who is such a charmer.
Well, that's nice to hear. I mean, I love Eloise. She's kind of quiet. The lot of the story and the road trip, the dynamic between them, I got a lot of that from my relationship to my grandfather. A lot of people, when they read it initially, said that they wish she talked more, that she didn't talk enough in the book. But I didn't talk a lot as a child, so that might be informing why she didn't talk more.
Right.
I was absorbing things, and I think I was really in awe and probably a little bit intimidated by some of the people around me, the older people around me that I was really impressed and inspired with. And I think that comes across in the character as well. I'm glad to see she's charming.
She is. When she talks, she makes it count.
Yeah.
And she is determined to be fully engaged in this trip of theirs.
Yes.
So tell us about the basic existential errand that Johnny is on and what he's doing on this road trip.
He has had a very long and complicated life, and he wound up working for, you could say, a criminal. I don't know how Johnny would feel about that, even though he's called a criminal a lot in the book. But he owes a debt, and someone has told him if he does not pay back this debt, that he will be killed. And he has buried in holes all around the state of Florida money that he stole himself, usually, and has been hiding it there. He's been keeping it there. So the road trip is him going around the state of Florida trying to dig up these holes full of money, the money that he's left buried at various places that were significant in his past. And on his very first stop, which is to his brother's house, he realizes his dead brother's girlfriend is still living in the house, and he realizes he has a niece, Eloise, and she goes with him for the rest of the journey.
So tell us a little bit about the Ripkins and their unusual talents. I mean, Johnny draws maps, and maps are so important in this book. His brother Franklin could climb walls, and Eloise's talent is gradually revealed to us over the course of this book. But tell us about some of the others as well.
He has two other cousins, and one is named Simone, and the way her talent, the way it's described, is that she can make people think they're in the presence of the most beautiful woman they've ever met, but that's a little bit complicated because it's not just physical beauty, it's about how people respond and interact with her, so she can be very persuasive. She's very good at getting people to feel their safe in her presence and to confess things to her. The other cousin's power is much more straightforward in that he can spit firecrackers. So he calls himself a dragon, but it's not really fire. It's more like a popping sound and like a spark. There are other characters. One of Simone's, his cousin's grandsons, can see in the dark. Johnny's father could see in the dark. He has another uncle that can imitate anyone's voice.
I loved him. I love the way these voices would just suddenly appear.
Yeah. And for all of them, it's kind of a compulsion as well. He says his Uncle Bart can be very scary with his voices, but it's really a compulsion. And it becomes kind of a compulsion for all of them.
And the Ripkins also played an unusual role in the civil rights movement, the freedom of movement. Keeping their heroes safe. I wonder if you'd talk a bit about that.
Yeah, that's Johnny's interpretation of it. And again, he's a map maker. So he's very concerned with what his Uncle Bart says, that escape will become natural to him. And I think that's just sort of the way he conceptualizes answers to problems, is if he sees an obstacle, trying to figure out what is the way out of this situation. And he does not think of himself as a hero. He's trying to create exit routes and possible alternative paths for the people that he sees as the real actors in the civil rights movement. I think that, in a sense, is what all of them were trying to do in the Justice Committee. Is there anything we can do to help with these talents that we've been given? How can we assist people that are the real heroes of the story?
Now, another one of the things I love about this book is that, as talented and unusual as the Ripkins are, you really captured the emotional currents of family life, old grudges, the pride in shared history, a sense of obligation and affection and specialness and responsibility to each other.
Well, again, I think a lot of it is inspired by my own family. There's a lot of not just my grandfather, but certainly in Simone, there's a lot of my grandmother. And I have four uncles as well, who are all very, very different people, and they're all exceptional in their own way. So I really did draw a lot upon my own experiences growing up. So that's where a lot of that comes from.
Well, I love thinking that even though they're superheroes, I want them to be there, drawing maps and scaling walls and catching things. I love knowing them all, but you must have given some thought to what would be your superpower if you chose one.
I don't know. I think everybody kind of has a superpower. I think it's everybody has things that make them different. And maybe some people have wants, or they want to write a book or whatever, they want to do something that doesn't always make sense to other people. And so I don't know what my superpower would be. Whatever superpower I would have, I probably already have it. That's another element of the book, is self-acceptance. And I really think that at the end of the trip, that's what Eloise is learning. That was sort of the point of it. Whatever it is that makes you feel alienated or strange, to find a way to accept yourself and embrace yourself for whoever you are, even if other people don't understand it.
Well, I love it when the hammer says to her, how is anybody going to recognize you, Eloise, if you're scared to show people who you really are?
That's right. And I wholeheartedly endorse that. I think that's very true. We can't be afraid of ourselves.
If you want to say your superhero power is writing, I will go along with that.
Well, that's it. Right. I didn't mean it like quite like that, but yeah, it'd probably be that my desire to write, I think, it would be the equivalent of it.
Yes. So absolutely. Okay. And acting on it, acting on that desire.
Right.
We've been talking with Lady Hubbard, whose marvelous new novel is The Talented Ripkins. You can meet her Tuesday, August 8th at 6 o'clock at Octavia Books. Lady, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Lots of New Orleanians know Tom Sankton as a wonderful clarinetist, but he's a journalist who spent 22 years as a writer, editor, and foreign correspondent for Time magazine, including 10 years as the Paris bureau chief and senior European correspondent. He's the author of Death of a Princess, The Investigation, Song for My Fathers, a New Orleans Story in Black and White. You know I love that book. The thriller, The Armageddon Project, and now he's back with a nonfiction page-turner, The Betancourt Affair, The World's Richest Woman and the Scandal That Rocked Paris. Tom Sankton, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Now, this is the perfect beach book. It has everything you want in a beach book. Scandal, art, money, politics, history, murder. I mean,
yes.
It's just... So... What a story. Now, how did you first get interested in it? I mean, I'm sure everybody was interested in it in France. But...
Yeah, they were. And I spend most summers in France. And so in 2010, this story peaked. That's when it really exploded into the headlines in France. And it was just a feeding frenzy of media coverage. And I got over there in the beginning of the summer. And as I would read the newspapers and listen to this coverage on radio and TV, it just was this incredible story. Here's this guy, a gay photographer, writer, artist, who's accused of exploiting this elderly woman who happens to be the world's richest woman to the tune of, at least on paper, $1 billion, something over $1 billion. And then her daughter got fed up with this, her only heir, and sued him for, I guess, what you'd call elder abuse or abusive weakness, they call it. And that was the beginning of this huge legal battle that then went on for 10 years. So this attracted my attention. I thought, wow, that's a pretty good story. And although I no longer am on staff of Time Magazine or any other publication, I do have links and to certain magazines and to do occasional freelance articles. So I contacted Graydon Carter, who's the editor of Vanity Fair, and said, what do you think? Is this an interesting story? And he loved it. The photographer, who François-Marie Bagnier, who was the beneficiary of all this largesse, happens also to have done photo work for Vanity Fair. So Graydon thought that was a great story, and I spent most of the summer working on it. So the story came out in October 2010, and the state of play at that point was not what it is now. The case hadn't gone to court yet, but it was a big, fascinating affair. And after that, I lost sight of it. I didn't follow it after that. And in 2015, it went to trial, finally, and the New York Times did a big piece on it. And my literary agent saw the Times piece and then got in touch with me and said, this would be a great book for the U.S. market. Do you want to make a proposal? So I said, sure, why not? That's how the book project came up. But originally, my interest was piqued by this intense media coverage in 2010.
Now, often, you know, a lot of people read a magazine article and think that would be a great book. And then there's no there, you know, but this... it's such a complicated story. You would think no magazine article could do it justice entirely.
Well, it didn't. I mean, the article I did was something like 6,000 words, so it was a pretty substantial article. But there are so many strands to this story, Susan. It has this main thread that I just described, the alleged exploitation of this very wealthy woman by her protege. But there's also a political subplot, which almost brought down the then president, Nicolas Sarkozy, and even last year contributed to the fact that he failed in his attempt to run for re-election.
So, but tell us a little bit about the woman at the heart of this story, about Liliane Bettencourt.
Liliane is a fascinating and tragic woman in many ways. She was the only child of Eugene Schuller, who is a fascinating character in his own right. He founded L'Oreal, the cosmetics firm. And she was half orphan because her mother died when she was 5 years old. And so she was absolutely fascinated by her father. She had this real obsessive attachment to her father, who was, you know, a very impressive man in his own right. Although, another one of the subplots, he was a Nazi collaborator during the war and financed pro-fascist movements before the war. And anyway, he's a man who had his flaws, but a very successful businessman, a very wealthy man, very brilliant man. And she grew up under his influence in his shadow. And then she married a man, André Bettencourt, who was from a prominent family in Normandy. And I think in the eyes of Eugene Schuller, he brought to the family some blue blood, some, you know, kind of a veneer of social status. And so he was, I wouldn't say pushed on Liliane as a husband, but her father certainly encouraged her to marry him. It turned out he was not particularly interested in women. But her money financed his political career. He was a minister in a number of governments, and this is another subplot. He gave a lot of political contributions, which were illegal under French law, to various political parties and candidates over the years. That's how he financed his own or furthered his own political career. So she grew up, and in her married life, she was always the daughter of or the wife of.
Yep.
And she was a woman who had ambitions to be creative, to live a life beyond the confines of this bourgeois, super wealthy, codified life that she lived. Also, she had a role with respect to L'Oreal, particularly after her father died. She didn't have a management role, but she had an important role in various committees. And she was very much wedded to following the business of then the figures and the decisions relating to L'Oreal. But that was her life. That was her life. And then I think ultimately she was a woman who longed for a richer, more exciting life. And that's what François-Marie Bagnier ultimately brought to her. And that's why she had such an attraction to him. And really, she was in love with him. Although he's homosexual, I don't think they had a physical relationship, but they had what I called an intense platonic relationship.
Well, one of the things you bring home in pure business terms, this is a fascinating story as well, because I don't think I realized how big a company L'Oreal was until I read this book. And you make the point over and over again that it could rock the entire French economy, the fate of what happens there.
Yeah, well, it's a great story of a kind of corporate history. And the founding of L'Oreal by Eugene Schuller just came about because he was a young, ambitious young chemist. And a barber approached him one day and asked him to work with him on trying to
invent
a synthetic hair dye, because up until then, the dyes that were available would kind of make your hair fall out of him. They were toxic. And he invented this synthetic hair dye, and that became the basis for this company he founded, L'Oréal, which became a major, major French company. It's the world's biggest cosmetics firm. And during this, I guess, the evolution of this affair, once it became a public legal battle, there was concern that L'Oréal's junior partner, which is Nestlé, the Swiss firm Nestlé, might take advantage of the destabilization of the Bettencourt family to try to seize control of L'Oréal, and it would then become a Swiss company. And, you know, the French government particularly is very jealous of and protective of their industries. And this is what you call a kind of a flagship industry for
right.
France. It's prestige, it's culture, it's glamour. You know, it's really at the heart of the image that France likes to project around the world. So it became a concern of the government, and particularly of President Sarkozy, to try to prevent this affair from triggering a takeover by this huge Swiss firm. So that's another one of the subplots.
So what was it like for you to spend time with these people?
That was fascinating. I have to tell you, François-Marie Barnier was a charming character, although devious and devilish in a lot of ways. Well, I think he's a megalomaniac, but a very talented and charming and fascinating one, very egocentric. But he'd been very badly treated by French writers and in the French press. And I think he figured, well, here's somebody from outside. I didn't have a horse in that race. And I think he probably figured that I would probably be a fairer narrator of his story than what he'd experienced so far. So little by little, I developed an entree with him. I mean, I wouldn't say certainly not a friendship, but there was a lot of exchange.
So you are someone with a great fondness for France. You've lived there so long, off and on, and spending more time there now. And I'm curious how this moved you, writing this book. Do you feel you were surprised? Were there revelations in this book about
certainly.
France for you?
Certainly, yeah. Since I left Time magazine in 2001, and although I'd continued to live in France part of the year, I hadn't really worked like a workaday journalist in quite a few years, so occasionally a freelance piece or something. And this was a very intense reporting and research job over 2 years. And it really threw me back into the swim of things as an active journalist. You know, the interviews and the research and the really kind of thinking about how things work in France. And also, because I was going here and there to appointments and interviews, I was really living in Paris a lot more than I do usually, because I live slightly outside of Paris in a suburb called Saint-Germain-en-Laye. And so it really threw me back into the life of being a working journalist in Paris.
Boy, all the chops are there, though, let me tell
yeah.
you, because it's such a page-turner.
Yeah, well, thank
it's,
you.
You know, really, I couldn't put it down.
You know, it has aspects of a courtroom drama. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of an upstairs, downstairs tale. There's a whole aspect of
the servants, the
yeah.
employees. It's
yeah.
amazing.
Downton Abbey kind of thing with the servants all kind of at each other's necks and trying to buy for the favors of Monsieur or Madame. And, you know, the internal workings of the home of extremely wealthy people. You know, this was fascinating. And it's also a mother-daughter drama, because the relationship between Liliane and her daughter, Françoise, was very tense and really tragic in a lot of ways. And you can't say whose fault it was, really. It just, Liliane really thought Françoise disappointed her. Françoise was not the daughter she wanted, because Françoise was sensitive. She was kind of introverted. She's fascinated by the piano and practices 5 hours a day. And the mother wanted her to be more dynamic and to get involved at L'Oréal. And just over the years, there was this very fraught relationship. And then Barnier arrives, works his way into the family nest, and Françoise couldn't abide this. And, you know, you can make an argument that what really motivated her suit was personal jealousy.
Right,
against Barnier and resentment against her mother. So there's that whole, you know, human drama. In a lot of ways, it's a Greek tragedy.
It is. And yeah. I love the way one thing leads to another yeah. and another and yeah. another. It's just an amazing read. We've been talking with Tom Sankton, whose wonderful new book is The Bettencourt Affair, The World's Richest Woman and the Scandal That Rocked Paris. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Lady Hubbard, launches her wonderful debut novel, The Talented Ripkins, in conversation with Jamie Attenberg, author of All Grown Up. That's Tuesday, August 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses The Veins of the Ocean, Wednesday, August 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Four local authors talk about their new children's books Wednesday, August 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Appearing are Kathy Schrenk, author of A Dog Steals Home, Del Rio Gardner, author of A Promise Fulfilled, Julie Rowley, author of The Little Purple Mardi Gras Bead, and Pamela Callie Bankston, author of Frizzy Frida's Gymtastrophe. The Octavia Book Science Fiction Book Club discusses Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children by Ransom Riggs, Saturday, August 12th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Don Reno Langley reads from and signs The Morning Parade, Monday, August 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The deadline for submissions to the 2017 Ernest Gaines Award for Literary Excellence is coming up August 15th. This award honors rising African American authors of fiction while recognizing Louisianan Ernest Gaines' many contributions to the literary world. Submissions may be novels or short story collections published in 2017 or galleys of 2017 publications. The winner will be announced in November, will receive a $10,000 award, and be honored at a ceremony in January in Baton Rouge. For more information, visit ErnestJGainesAward.org. If you're in the mood for a road trip, consider the Mississippi Book Festival, which takes place in Jackson, August 19th, starting at 9 a.m. More than 60 authors will be there, including Jamie Attenberg, John Gregory Brown, Robert Olin Butler, Richard Ford, Tim Gotro, Ellen Gilchrist, Greg Iles, Ron Rash, and Michael Ferris Smith. Many events take place at the Mississippi State Capitol, others at the Galloway Sanctuary. Coming up in early fall, the Diana Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction will be presented Friday, September 8th at 6 at the NIMS Fine Arts Center at the Academy of Sacred Heart, 4301 St. Charles Avenue. The winner for Distinguished Body of Work is Canadian novelist Louise Penny, and the winner for Debut Novel is Trudy Nan Boyce of Atlanta for Out of the Blues. This is a ticketed event. Tickets are available at Octavia Books or octaviabooks.com and will be exchanged for a copy of Louise Penny's new book, Glass Houses, at the event. The Hill Memorial Library at LSU has a fascinating exhibit, Paper Tigers and Bibliobeast, featuring works focusing on the relationship between humans and other animals, as documented in the rare books, photographs, historical documents, and print materials in the LSU Library Special Collections. It's free and open to the public and runs through September 16th. For directions and hours of operation, visit lib.lsu.edu/special. Or call 225-578-6544. And coming up, the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival's annual writing contests are now open. And this year, they've added a new category in flash fiction. Here are the categories and deadlines. Short stories of up to 1,000 words are due November 8th. One-act plays no longer than an hour, November 1st. 2 to 4 poems with a combined length of up to 400 lines, November 15th. And fiction up to 7,000 words is due November 30th. For more information, visit TennesseeWilliams.net/contest. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at TheReadingLife@WWNO.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.